peppered with anecdotes from real life in order to try to make it come to life. In the world of the 50s going into the 60s, there was a seismic world shift. Many colonies, former colonies of Britain, France, Italy, Germany, what have you, were finally achieving their independence. There was optimism in the world that a new world order, one that was based on freedom, freedom from oppression, freedom from colonialism, was rampant throughout the world. And at that time, socialism, or Marxist-Leninism, was the ideology of choice, the ideology of liberation. And many Muslim countries also adopted, including Egypt and many others, because they believed that that was kind of an alternative. But here in the United States, it had already gone through the 50s, a decade of the civil rights. And the civil rights struggles of Martin Luther King, which you are probably very familiar with. And there were, the images are ingrained in our memory of people being hosed down and beaten in the South. But by the time the 1960s started to, people were beginning to be restless with the gains of that particular time. And they felt that it was too slow, too deliberate, and they were getting impatient. There were many reasons for this. The urban ghettos in the Midwest, in the North and the South, were in terrible condition. Drugs had infested the neighborhoods. I remember when I was in my teens, it seemed like every other person was a junkie. And urban squalor, people were living in horrible squalor, much worse than anything you can imagine now. I mean, where I lived, ceilings would collapse. Ceilings collapsed on my mother. Ceilings collapsed on my brother. To get to my door, which I was on the fifth floor, I had to walk over junkies that were laid out, vomit coming from them, blood on the walls where they used to put the needles in. They would all the walls were marked. There were bags of drugs everywhere, and the living conditions. I went years with no heat and hot water. Years with no heat and hot water. And this building was owned by the city. They didn't get up the garbage. So you had people that were just ready to explode because they saw the conditions there were so bad. And then the violence. I mean, we became so used to violence. And I'll give you a story of how insensitized I was to violence. I was coming down from my house and I had a basketball in my hand. It was at night. I lived on the fifth floor. I had a shot. When I got down to the second floor landing, I saw a white guy laid out there. And just to show you how insensitive we are, I just went and looked at him. "You all right?" He said, "Yeah." And I went, "Okay." And I walked right over him. And then when I walked out the building, I saw the cops running in. It was a culture of violence. It was a culture of drugs. It was something that, it was a powder keg waiting to explode. And people reacted to that. There were riots, major riots in the streets. In Watts, there was a great riot. In Detroit, there were tanks in the street, tanks, to try to control the rage of destruction that was going on. This led to the people, young people started to react to that. And they started creating organizations. One of the major organizations that was created was the Black Panther Party, which was a socialist organization. And they adopted all the outward rhetoric of militancy. You know, they would have black leather jackets, a black beret, they'd be posing with like the shotguns. But what was an important thing, they were not violent. They only feigned that. You know, they were there to defend the community, but they were about school breakfast programs, health care, defense of the community from police brutality. That's what they were about. And these were all young people. Young people who were feeling this sense of they have to fight for their liberation. They have to fight. They have to do something. They have to be active in order to achieve the righting of the wrongs that they saw happening in their neighborhood. They saw their neighborhoods ridden with drugs. They saw prostitution. They saw police oppression. And they wanted to react against that. And they did. They did it by forming organizations. And they formed organizations and they started to give service to the community. And this was their mentality. In New York, actually it started in Chicago, the Young Lords was the Latino version of that. And I became associated with it. And the person who told me about it was 14 years old. And when he first came to me, I was 16, and he was telling me about the Young Lords. I thought he was kind of nuts. And he was only 14. And then by the next year, I was 17 years old, I was selling newspapers for the organization. By the time I was 18, I was helping but there was a mass organization part of the Young Lords Party called Committees to Defend the Community, and they would help people organizing rent strikes because the landlords didn't want to help. They abandoned their buildings. So we would organize tenants to strike against, you know, the landlords to force them to provide services, to fix the plumbing, to clean the repair walls, repair ceilings, things of that nature. And we were also interested in making sure that healthcare was provided and providing free breakfast programs for kids and daycare, which was at that time unheard of. Unheard of. The schools weren't getting free breakfast. So we decided on our own to do that. We're all young. We're all very, very young. I remember that at times when I got into college, we were interested in accurate information. The Afro-Americans, they wanted accurate information about their history. So they wanted black studies programs. The Latinos also wanted Puerto Rican studies programs. We didn't want to hear about the West or this or that. We wanted to hear something about ourselves. Because people really wanted to establish a sense of identity. That led sometimes to the takeover of universities, which I participated in. Two of them that I remember. And and let me tell you the spirit of the youth at that time. I would get a phone call from Ibrahim. Ibrahim was 15 years old. He would call me and say, we're taking over Columbia, or we're taking over City. And me and Yahya would say, we're going to be right there. And we would participate. We would have the midnight watch. And the midnight watch, we'd be in there, looking out the window, waiting for a raid from the police. That was our job. To be a lookout, to try to let everybody alert somebody who were going to be raided. Now, in those days, that was a very real threat. I'll give you an example. One day, there was a march, an unscheduled march, of the Young Lords, big group, marching through the streets on Madison Avenue. They were, again, just marching in protest of all the conditions that we were suffering in our neighborhoods. I saw a bunch of blue vans show up. And out of them, the doors flew open, out rushed out what we used to call in those days the TPF. They were called a tactical police force. They were blue helmets. They came out and they were beating everybody. Marchers, non-marchers, anybody in sight, and they were busting heads. And I was standing there looking on 110th Street, looking as they were coming this way. And I was 17 at the time, and I said, I gotta get out of here. I ran. I remember running into a building, looking behind me, and what I saw was one kid running and a police member of a billy club running right after me. I had no illusions in those days about what country I was living in. Police in our neighborhoods were armies of occupation. They were not there to serve and protect. Because that's the kind of abuse that people would go through in those days. Now there was another group at that particular time. They were called the Nation of Islam, but in reality they had nothing to do with Islam. They were what you call the Black Muslims. And they believed in a heretical version of Islam, that Elijah Muhammad was the prophet of Allah, spoke of Allah, and that God came in the part of them in the form of W.B. Far Muhammad. Again, another tremendous heresy. But what was interesting about them is that their program, their program for self-empowerment, Black empowerment, was extremely powerful. They had businesses. They believed in economic independence, so they had restaurants, they had real estate, they had farms. They coined the term "do for self." But people, our stadium tank, which doesn't exist anymore, was the best Philly cheesesteak you could ever possibly imagine, the best variation of it you could possibly imagine. They had Shabazz restaurants, and their restaurants always were natural, healthy food restaurants, way before it became fashionable. And the carrot cake and bean pies that are so common now, even in American culture, were started by them. They were the originators of that. Also, in a world where there were drugs, prostitution, and all manner of vice, their women stood out. Their women used to dress like our Muslim women, with the exception that they didn't bring their veils across, they wore them back. But they were impeccably dressed, beautiful, all the time. And they commanded respect when they walked in the street. People admired them. Not like, it was a tremendous admiration in the ghetto community for these people who were dressed that way. The men were always dressed with suits, bow ties, and sometimes with hats. And they also looked, I mean, this was a big difference from what was occurring in the society. They stopped smoking, they stopped drinking, they stopped gambling, they stopped running around with women, they started living a moral life, and these people were not even true Muslims. Not in the sense that we know as such. Yet they exemplified this thing, so much so that they were admired and respected in the community. Another thing that they had was a group called the Food of Islam, the FOI. They were a paramilitary organization. They learned martial arts. They functioned as a unit. And they were feared, admired, and respected. Nobody would mess with a Muslim, especially a Muslim woman. Nobody would touch them because they would have to deal with them. Could you imagine that? No one would even dare speak a disrespectful word to a woman who was dressed with a long dress and a veil in the ghetto community. Nobody. Because they knew that behind them there would be an organization that they would fear and respect. So those women commanded respect wherever they went, and the men commanded respect wherever they went. Now look at the journey so far. You go from guys from the ghetto who are experiencing the worst kind of oppression. Then they decide to do something about it. Then you have these organizations spring up, like the Nation of Islam. Some people took that path. Other people took the path of, say, SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or Black Panther Party, or the Young Lords Party. Now you got to remember that a lot of people that are doing this are very young people. Some of them are in their 20s, a lot of them are in their teens. Now something happens, especially around the mid-60s. Around the mid-60s, after Malcolm's death, after Malcolm is assassinated, a lot of people start looking at Malcolm's life. They started looking at it after he converted to Islam, but he didn't live long after that. His assassination drew a lot of attention to what he was talking about and to the religion that he finally adopted, the true religion of Allah. And there was an explosion of conversions. But the people who converted were the people that were not only inspired by the religion of Islam, but his view of it. His view of it that it was about that this deen was an answer to the oppression that he was experiencing. It's supposed to be an activist religion, a religion that will liberate people and bring human justice and human rights to people. That was what was very important, because that's how Muslims thought at the time. That's how they thought at the time. Islam wasn't just a religion isolated from life. These people who were accepting Islam had been through that journey. And now they were seeing something that not only gives them salvation in the hereafter, but actually can change the condition of their people. This is how they saw it. And this will give you an understanding of what came later. The types of organizations that the Muslims formed. The American Muslims started to form organizations that were geared to empowerment of their people, and they were against oppression, and they wanted to liberate them from all types of slavery, not spiritual, mental, political, and economic. And if this is key to understanding the movements that came later. You had two major organizations in the first wave. You had the Darul Islam, which at that time had more chapters than, it was founded in 1962, but it started exploding later. It had more chapters than any masjid-based group in the 60s. It was a huge organization. The base of it was in New York. Then you had the American Muslim Mission. The American Muslim Mission took a different role, because the American Muslim Mission was, after the death of Elijah Muhammad in 1975, Wallace Muhammad, decided to do away with the teachings of his father and wanted to bring Islam into the Sunni mainstream. So he changed the name of the organization to the American Muslim Mission, and he started to adapt more Sunni teachings. But one thing he didn't change was a very big racial orientation. He still held Elijah, his father, who was a heretic, in high regard, as well as Wallace Muhammad, the person who claimed to be Allah. And he started calling calling Afro Americans Bilalites. He wanted to have some kind of attachment to Bilal, since Bilal was the African Sahaba. So he started calling, he said, now on we're going to be called the Latinists, which some people found ridiculous. But the Dar al-Islam began to have certain elements that were very similar to the Nation of Islam, in that they had also a rock, thunder. And that organization was a paramilitary organization, but they were a little bit different. You know, you could always tell a Dar al-Islam Ra'd member because he would wear a long flow combat boots and a fatigue jacket, you know? And then they would go through drills and all these kind of things. They had a real combat appearance. And this was also as a deterrent against the Nation of Islam, because when these Sunni organizations started to form, the Nation of Islam, this is prior to Elijah's death, saw these guys as competition. Because now, there wasn't just one Muslim in the block. They were Muslims now who were calling these other guys mushriks and kafirs. And, you know, they were not used to that. So that was problematic. You know, that was going to lead to an explosion sooner or later. After this, there was another evolution of an organization, and that was the Islamic Party. Now, the Islamic Party represented something different because they tried to align themselves with the movements that were occurring in the Middle East, like Jamaat Islami and Ikhwanul Muslimin. Organizationally, it was mostly influenced by Jamaat Islami. It was officially organized in 1971. It was the first constitutionally based Muslim American group. They had a constitution. Other groups were kind of loosely based, so they would just, you know, have imam, and that was about it. So, you know, we used to majority call those, you know, ghetto monarchies or storefront kingdoms, because they were just, you know, just the imam basically ruled over the organization, wasn't elected, people just followed him, and that was all there was to it. Once the Islamic Party created something different, because having a constitution, the person had to be elected, there were terms, there were rules, there were membership expectations. There were expectations of people who were in the leadership. The organization, the guidance council, the central committee, all these things had defined limits. And that was something that was inherited from the Jamaat Islami Ikhwan Muslimin. As a matter of fact, when they finally put together their constitution, it was basically a melding of both those constitutions. Ideologically, they were still linked to the organizationally they were Jamaat Islami, and they believed in the Islamic movement as a principle. But ideologically, they were very much influenced by Malcolm X, in the idea of that Islam is supposed to be a revolutionary struggle. It's supposed to be a struggle to break the bonds of oppression, and oppression could be in the form of anything. It could be economic oppression, it could be spiritual oppression, it could be political oppression, economic oppression. So they didn't shy away from the term, that's why it was used in that, Islam was called at that time in the books an ideology. And when you hear that term ideology, that's the same term that the Marxists and the Leninists use for ideology, they use revolution. They tried to use those terms because they were using a different mindset. You know, they kind of believed that using certain other words would connote other things. They wanted a different type of Muslim, a different type of mindset. They were involved in many different things. They had a restaurant, for example, called a Hunger Stopper, a bookstore, a bakery, a 24-hour cab service. Now, these brothers, all of them young, And another thing, before I go on any further on that, where did these brothers come from? Where did these activist brothers came from who wanted to become an American version of the Jamaat Islami? They came right off the campuses. They came right from the those movements that we were talking about before, the Black Panthers, the Young Lords, and what happened, they came from those movements. So they came there with a mentality for activism, for active involvement in their community. But with the added benefit that now they thought that now we have the real solution, and that's Islam. So they already came with this fervor for activism. So the Islamic Party was peppered with guys that had just right, they were activists right off the campus or right off from these organizations. And they immediately put that into practice. They thought the service to the community was, so immediately they started a Feed the Hungry Month during Ramadan. They didn't just have tarawih and prayer and no. They said, no, this is about showing something different. So they would feed the hungry, meaning the poor in the neighborhood. In the poor. They weren't fasting, but they were poor. So they wanted to show that Muslims are out there giving food, doing something in the community. We had an oppressed people's affairs community, just dealing with people who I knew and dealing with other organizations that were also interested in helping people who were poor, oppressed, and underprivileged. We had a school. Education was very important. The 24-hour camp service, I'm going to show you something about the spirit of sacrifice. The guys decided to pool their resources and become cab drivers. They would drive the same cab 24 hours a day, just rotating, 8-hour shifts. Take all their money and donate it to the organization only to just receive a stipend. Just to receive a stipend. The rest of it goes into the organization. That's the kind of sacrifice they had. That level of sacrifice. They would give it all here for Allah's sake. And just get a stipend. Just enough to live on. But it was enough to keep the organization machine rolling. This is the kind of spirit that was in these people. They had been through oppression. They knew what it felt like. They decided to do something about it. They wandered in the wilderness, trying socialism, Marxism, everything, until they came to Islam. And then when they came to Islam, they came with that fervor, that understanding that Islam is not, you know, just merely being in the masjid with a mishpat in your mouth reading Quran. We used to have people who would come to the mosque, and if we saw them hanging around for any length of time, we grabbed the broom and said, here, that classroom needs sweeping. You know, it's just this attitude of, we may have gone overboard with it, but that's how we thought. We thought that if you're going to be a Muslim and you're not striving to try to establish a mosque, what are you doing? What are you doing? So we had that attitude. We just say, here, this room. So I missed it. Go right over there. Sixth grade, right over there. Need some switching. Gotta do something. You've got to do something. And you've got to be part of the war and do it in an organized effort. Not scattered. You know. The Amir kept on saying to us, there is no Islam without Jamaat, there's no Jamaat without leadership. So therefore, we have to be constantly, you know, in our minds that we have the advantage of being an organized group, actively, and we were optimistic. I mean, really. When I was 22 years old, I thought by the time I was 30, America would be an Islamic state. So, I mean, that's the kind of optimism that we had. Also, we got the answer here. We'll be done by 30. You know? But that's the kind of idealism that we had at that time. Many Muslims have that. Many of us have that. We have that kind of spirit. When I came back to New York,
brothers asked me to come back to New York. When I went to the Islamic party years ago, it was to learn about Islam, learn about the movement, learn how that type of organization operates. But they were thinking, you're going to come back, right? Do it here. You're not going to stay over there. I was getting comfortable. They realized that. So they paid me a visit and said, it's time for you to come back. Well, that coming back paid off. A few years later, with the creation of Alianza Islamica. And that was an organization, again, by all these young guys. They're now getting a little older, but we still have that youthful spirit to try to create an organization in our neighborhoods. And that particular neighborhood was the Spanish Harlem neighborhood that I grew up in. So just like other places, we had to deal with the drugs on the block. So you had situations where, you know, the drug dealers on the block, they didn't like our presence, but we wanted to clean up that block, at least our block, which led us to confrontations. And one time we had a major confrontation with them, and I remember we were all holed up. We had a little storefront, right there, street level. And we were waiting for an attack. We don't know what was going to happen. We don't know if they're going to bust the windows. We don't know if they're going to spray the place. We had no idea. But we were all there. We felt we had to be there. You know, we felt we had to make a stand. And come what may, whatever was going to come through that window, mashallah. If it was going to be our time, it was our time. But we made our stand. And alhamdulillah, we cleaned up that block. So that's another thing too. The whole spirit of that. Unfortunately, or fortunately, the way you want to put it, the Islamic party, I jumped up a little bit, I went to the Alianza, but I skipped a little point here. The Islamic party and the Muslims in general were having great problems, as I told you, with the Nation of Islam. Well, eventually that blew up. While I was with the Islamic party, the Amir decided, as I told you before, Elijah Muhammad had died, and Wallace said, I'm going to take the organization in another direction. But he was still talking in a very favorable terms about his father, who claimed to be a prophet, and about Farid Muhammad. The Amir organization decided to get we had a journal called Al-Islam. Front page, Elijah and Farid must go. And the reasons why, as Muslims, they can no longer hold on to this heresy. So we decided to take these papers as a group and sell them on the streets. And we were going to do a tour. We were going to hit New York, we hit Times Square, we were going to hit Newark, we were going to hit Philly. We hit New York first, Times Square. There was no incident. The next day, though, while we were in Newark, I had no idea how much Newark was dominated by the Nation of Islam. In terms of, you know, we were getting harassed in the street constantly by them. And we could feel the tension in the air. They were looking like they wanted to pick a fight. So we broke for Salat. We went to the steps of this university, kind of almost like pyramid steps. And I was in the first group that made Salat. And the second group made Salat while we stood guard. I'm standing there looking across the street and I see a motorcade of cars coming. And they line up all along the block across the street. Very orderly. I was about to see how orderly they were. They all came as a line. One car, second car, all the way down the line, all parking. In a nice row. Doors open, lots of guys get out. They form like a line, and they start walking towards us. And I'm looking at them. They're all dressed up. I know who they were. They were a nation of Islam. Maybe the food of Islam. They're coming towards us. You know, when people want to start a fight, they'll just say anything like, you know, I heard you disrespected my sister or some kind of garbage like that. Something, the guy said something or other. Then they came after us. They had, I didn't know it at the time when they were coming up to us, but they had time irons, claw hammers, billy clubs, guns, and they started to beat us up. I got my head bashed, you know, cracked open. There was blood streaming around my face. I ran down to a store to call for help. Two other guys were beat up really bad. One was knocked to the ground and they were stomping his back so bad he couldn't even feel his legs. So they put me in the ambulance with two other guys. And I never saw an ambulance that size again. There were all three of us in that ambulance. So that must have been the biggest ambulance I've ever seen. There were three of us, all three of us were in there. One guy was beat up badly, couldn't feel his legs. I was the least one hurt compared to them. So as we're speeding out to the hospital, the guy comes over to the hospital, and one of the guys at the ambulance attendants asking, why did they beat you up? And I was laying there, and I didn't answer him. I just went into my pocket, and I had a brochure on a slant. And I handed it to him, and I remember getting blood on it. And I handed it to him, and I said, this is why. This is why. When we got to the hospital, some brothers from Newark came over. And they saw that even the hospital staff was full of Nation of Islam members. So they feared that these guys would finish us off during the night while we were in the hospital. So the brothers came all the way from Washington in a motorcade to get us out. They drove all the way up from Washington immediately, and they escorted us out of the city. When we got back, we were told not to tell our wives what was happening, so I had to tell them this. Somebody hit me with a chair or something like that. I had to tell my wife something. You know, because he didn't want to panic the wives. Because he wanted to wait because he was going to write a scathing response back. You know, and that's when the wives found out. We published, you know, criticizing them for the attack. Years later, I saw that guy I handed the brochure to. I recognized him. He came to me and he said, I'm the guy that you gave that brochure to while you were laying on your back and you handed me that bloody brochure. He had taken shahada. I'm giving up. He had taken shahada. I was living only a few blocks away from a Nation of Islam temple. They could have come to my house. Yet I felt defiant. And you know what? I wasn't the only one. A lot of us felt defiant. Even though they threatened our lives, even though they had beat us up, even though they had bloodied us, even though they could come and do it again, and I was living just a few blocks from them, we thought we could take that. We'll go and do that. We'll take it again. We'll withstand anything. Because our resolve was that strong. So, and remember, these are all young people. If this is talking about the youth, this is what the youth had to deal with. This is what it was to establish Islam. Now we're, you know, we're past that time. That was 40 years ago, 30 years ago. I don't know if your parents ever discussed those times that you were, even if you have parents that were Muslim from that period. But it was a reality for most of us that we endured. And I wasn't the only one. I was typical, there was a lot of people who were just like me at that time. Better. But we all have that same spirit. I've been given the dread of 10 minute warning, so I'll try to conclude. I'm just taking you through a brief journey of my time. A very brief journey. The time I lived with the people who were also young, full of dreams and aspirations. The truth is that I'm old now. And my energy has waned, and maybe my joints, you know, are reminders that the car is going to stop soon. I get trotted out from time to time to give a history lesson, which is probably the only thing I'm good for now. But those who came before you were inspired by their time to actively seek change. They were not afraid to use the word revolutionary. And I don't mean it in the sterile contemporary usage of a revolutionary razor. I mean in the seismic paradigm shift in social, political, economic relations that affect all spheres of life. Many of those early young Muslims that tried the promises of socialism, black and Latino militancy, and extreme national and racial pride, but found all those systems wanting. Only Allah's deen, Islam, provided a total solution that encompassed every facet of life, most importantly, the spiritual. The one thing that seems to be missing from every other system. The thing that actually makes better people. Devoted servants of Allah, the Most High. You young people that are here, what will your story be in 40 years? Take notice of this and heed. You're writing it now. Thank you. Assalamu alaikum.
I didn't say at the beginning, he's my father-in-law, my wife's father. So inshallah, we have a few minutes for questions and answers. Any comments and things, please feel free. Take advantage of this opportunity. And he's going to be going back to New York, so we want to make sure that if you have any questions or comments, please ask it now.